happy trails to you. Until we meet again,
happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together?
Sing a song and bring the Saudi weather. Happy trails to you. Here we meet again.
Happy trails to you. Here we meet again.
Paranoid Planet, you know what? Someday you will go far. And quite frankly, I hope you stay there.
In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. In the kingdom of the paranoid, the one-eyed man is a spy. This is Paranoid Planet.
I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Esta nunca ha sido dictadura, señores. Esta es dicta blanda.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
Like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay.
I'm not gonna give you a question. You are fake news.
Silent Green is people!
Welcome to episode 8 of the Paranoid Planet podcast. I am your host, Michel Jacques Gagné, recording this program from a soft chair. Soft chair. I can't say that. From a soft chair inside a cozy basement studio that's lodged in a gigantic circular rock hurtling through space and into the future at an astounding 67,000 miles per hour, which I have to say because our guest co-host is American, but we all know that it's actually 107,000 kilometers per hour everywhere else outside the United States. This episode is, sadly for some and not too soon for others, our last official show of Season 2, which, like Season 1, ended up lasting a lot longer than a standard podcasting season. But then, we like to take our time here on the Paranoid Planet, where the atmosphere is a bit thicker with fear and suspicion, and where the gravity of our program topics weighs heavier than the ones you find on all those fluffy podcasts that you fill the rest of your sad existence with. But just like the break we took after Season 1, that doesn't mean we won't be streaming some bonus episodes in the coming months. Though it will give us more time to nap, to do some research, to prepare for our next season, and to reinforce our conspiracy bunker in preparation for, egad, another 4 years of Trumpspiracies. With me, as always, is my co-producer, co-host, and favorite nunchuck-wielding ninja robot, Joanne Danielle Lijo. Say hello, Joanne.
Hey, guys. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
So how does it feel to be at the end of another season, Joanne?
Strange. It's the beginning of the year, and we're ending.
We're ending a little late.
It's so weird.
Our seasons are about a year and a half long, I guess. So it's not like Netflix, where they dump 10 episodes at the same time. We like to stretch out the joy.
A lot of material.
Yeah. Did you think that our podcast would last this long? When did we start? We started officially streaming in January 2020, right? Just before the COVID hit and we were all locked in our houses. So it's been 4 years.
Yeah. But wow. Lucky for us, the increment of you, the listeners, was actually ramping up with the pandemic.
It helped. Although what I noticed is every stand-up comedian who was suddenly out of a job started their own podcast, right? As you know, I play ball hockey on Saturdays with...
You're comparing yourself with...
Well, a lot of those guys are comedians. In fact, a lot of them are in the Just for Laughs, the festival circuit. That's where I met like Sugar Sammy and some of these other guys who they're still around. They're still doing shows. But, you know, for 2 years, they had to do shows on Zoom. So they figured, well, why not just do a podcast with their best friends? So I would say the competition was tight, but the technology advanced and everybody got suddenly used to listening to long-form discussions. It's not just Joe Rogan. And I think that played in our favor. Our numbers have increased fourfold in the second season. So we seem to have a lot more listeners than we had, which is great. And that will include someone that we're having here with us today. Before we do that, though, I want to point out to you, I went on Reddit and I kind of just punched in a question about, well, how long do most podcasts go on for? And I found out, I don't know where these stats come from, but it said 90% of podcasts don't get past episode 3. So 1.8 million people start a podcast and quit before they get to the fourth episode, right? So we beat that record. We're in the 10%, my friend. And then of the 200,000 podcasts that are left, 90% will quit after episode 20 or after 20 episodes. So that's another 180,000 people gone, right? It's starting to sound a little bit like Squid Game. I watched Squid Game, the first episode last night, and I fell asleep and I woke up and all these Korean guys getting shot in the head. So if podcasts are like that, you know, we haven't bitten the bullet yet. And then the third factoid I got was to be in the top 1% of podcasts in the world, you only need to publish 21 episodes of your podcast. Do you know how many episodes we've published?
Around 70.
I have no idea because we don't number them. We number them by group, right? By theme, which I think is good because that way we keep looking like we're young. But I think we've published about 75. That includes the ads, but then again, some of our episodes are like 3 hours long almost. So we're in the 1%. We are the 1%. And for a guy who was a fan of Bernie Sanders, I'm thinking you must feel really bad being one of the 1%.
No, not really.
No, you didn't sell out to the establishment to do a podcast?
No, because for me, first was to help you to get, you know, the podcast going.
Yes.
And then I realized this thing has to go bigger. We need to go video.
Okay.
The next frontier, you know, and then the sky's the limit, my friend.
So it's not just charity that's driving you.
No.
It's not the fact that you're trying to keep me from either drinking myself to death or getting in trouble. You actually have a plan here too.
Yeah, but it makes sense because that's my expertise, you know.
Yeah.
Video.
You're the tech guy.
So we started with audio. Okay, perfect. We knew how to do the thing, but... yeah, I need to go the next step. It's gonna be good.
So that's where we're headed. So who knows? Maybe season 3 will be a 3D experience in a theater near you, or something between that. All right, so we're going to bring in a friend here, one of our listeners who's reached out to us over the past year. He and I have had a number of online conversations. We almost met in person, not once, but twice. We might come this summer meet. He says he has plans to visit Montreal. So just like last season, we invited one of these listeners to co-host with us the very last episode. So it's going to force us to turn the tables a bit. We're going to interview him. And I think he's prepared a few questions for us as well. He is a teacher. He is a filmmaker. He is, or at least has been, an actor. He is a participant. He was a participant observer in his own true crime murder mystery, by which I mean he was a witness, not a participant in the crime. That's important to point out. I am speaking, of course, of Mr. Sean Gaston. Or if he were here in Canada, some people might mispronounce his name, Sean Gaston. So Mr. Gaston, Monsieur Gaston, say hello and welcome to the Paranoid Planet.
Hello, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So you live in Pennsylvania, and I drove through Pennsylvania many times. In fact, I went through in my podcast... my road trip that was featured in this season's podcast. You may or may not have listened to that because it was very quick, my time through Pennsylvania. But I did go to Gettysburg. I checked out some of the statues, found out what some people thought about Lincoln. And apart from that, I only visited the office museum in Scranton, which turns out it's basically just a room and a restaurant. And most of the TV show was filmed in California. But anyways, that's there. So that was my experience with Pennsylvania. I think I drove through last winter, stayed in a town called Harrisburg. And then when you sent me an email and I asked you where you were from, I think you said you teach in Harrisburg. Is that right?
I teach in Fleetwood, which is north of Reading. So little bit east of there.
So in other words, in the middle of a forest, in the mountains.
Kind of, yeah. It's about 20 minutes north of Redding, which I think might be like the fifth largest city or something like that in the state, fourth or fifth largest city in the state. But I live in Amish country in Lancaster County, PA. So I would have been just east of Gettysburg when you were there.
And you're not Amish yourself, are you?
No. I am not Amish. I'm not Mennonite. I'm just me.
Oh, I'm Mennonite. I became Mennonite. I don't know if there was any kind of a ceremony or whatever, but I switched communities and now I find myself Mennonite, though there was no dress code. I could still wear shiny buttons, which I appreciate. You also have a great beard, I think, because I saw you after we've contacted. I found you online. We'll be talking about some of the issues. You've been in a TV program. You've made a film, a documentary film of your own. And there were pictures online of a much younger you. And then now I see you've got this beautiful kind of, I wouldn't say a Chewbacca beard. That wouldn't be nice. But it is a very full beard with a little Dali mustache. It's something to be admired by a guy who's, you know, spends a lot of time growing and shaving hair. I do appreciate that, that mandible of yours.
Yeah. Growing hair has never been a problem for me, and it doesn't matter where, hair grows everywhere. Like, it's on the face, no problem. You want a handlebar mustache? Give me 3 weeks.
So I narrowly failed meeting you because I went down to Florida just a few weeks ago, and I think you had a touch of the flu or COVID. And
I had COVID, yes. It was bad. It was my third time with COVID, so the Bill Gates microchip is definitely not working. But yeah, it was my third time with COVID, and it was definitely the worst of the three.
Okay. Wow. All right. Well, I end up going to the Cracker Barrel, so I don't know whether I got the better or worse part of the deal. Probably worse. And then on my way back up, there was a horrible snowstorm, yes. So that you couldn't meet me. I was actually stuck for like 14 hours in a blizzard between somewhere between Georgia and Canada. Very slow. My wife would not let me drive because she was afraid that I would drive too fast in those conditions.
So I'm curious. I would assume in Montreal, you guys get much worse snowstorms than we get here.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes, but I hear Buffalo gets it worse than we do.
Buffalo, I mean, when it snows in Buffalo, they measure it in feet.
Yes.
But yeah, here it's, I mean, if we get 2 inches of snow, all the schools are shutting down, and it's almost like people forget how to drive, you know, on a wet, snowy road. It's pretty scary. But then, like I said, you go to a place like Buffalo, it snows a foot, and they're clearing it off the roads as quick as it's coming down. Like, they have it like really on lockdown. And I was just wondering if Montreal was the same way. Like, do your schools close often because of snow?
Yeah, but from 10 feet above. Yeah, we have like last week, remember, 10?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, we get about, you know, we measure it in centimeters, but I guess 4 or 5 inches of snow, we still go to work because the snow trucks and the salt trucks are all out in advance. The problem in Montreal is that the roads are horrible because of the salt and the constant thawing and freezing and the trucks that go by. So when they do clear out the snow, it's worse because you're hitting these potholes that can actually crack your chassis or whatever it is. So
I can believe that.
Quebec City is kind of like Buffalo, very white, very snowy. And it's pretty. Montreal, it's brown, it's yellow, it's gross because of the salt and the constant melting and rebuilding. So I don't particularly enjoy the winters here. It's very slushy. When I do go to Quebec City, I find that it feels more like a vacation. It actually feels like winter is nice. I used to go up there a lot for Christmas as a kid. And it is a different ecosystem. You know, it's just a little bit colder and a little bit more moist. And it's right, the St. Lawrence widens up there. So it's more of a, almost like a maritime climate, like Buffalo or I guess like Halifax or Maine or something like that. So to reel things in and move on with our show, how did you come to know about our podcast and why did you reach out to us?
So I drive about an hour one way to school. So I'm in my car an awful lot. So I'm constantly, you know, reading, listening to audiobooks, not reading while I drive, but listening to audiobooks while I drive. And I got into podcasts, listening to podcasts. I had a whole list of them, and one day I just decided in the search bar I was going to type in conspiracy theories, because I teach courses in conspiracy theories, and up pops this Paranoid Planet, and I clicked on it, and I started listening to it, and the second I heard Alex Jones yelling about gay frogs in the intro, I knew I found my podcast that right. that I was going to be listening to.
So it's kind of a love story, I guess. It's a kind of love story. You looked across a snowy room, and there you saw a gay frog. Never seen a gay frog you didn't like.
I saw Alex Jones yelling about gay frogs, and I knew I found my people.
And then you contacted me because you started teaching a class about Kennedy or about conspiracies in general?
So what happened was, I've been teaching a course at my high school, conspiracy theories, which was actually started by a suggestion from a student. He and I would talk about conspiracy theories on a daily basis. I mean, he had opinions about the Kennedy assassination. The 9/11 truther movement was in full swing. So he suggested that I should teach a course in conspiracy theory. So I approached our administration and figured out a way that we could use conspiracy theories as our vehicle to teach about critical thinking, media literacy skills, research techniques, ways to identify credible and non-credible sources, mis- and disinformation, and that type of stuff. And like I said, we just use conspiracy theories as the vehicle. So I taught that course for about 10 or 11 years. And then I always do course surveys with my students, exit surveys. And the biggest complaint that I kept getting from the students that were leaving the conspiracy theories class was that the course was only 18 weeks. They wanted more, which I guess is a really good thing. And I knew that they weren't going to make conspiracy theories a full year class. But then the principal suggested, why don't you write an upper-level conspiracy theories course? So I took the AP research seminar course, and I kind of watered that down. So now kids can pick a conspiracy theory or two that they would like to research, and they spend either 9 or 18 weeks researching that conspiracy theory and putting together a big class presentation. And just a few weeks ago, I was approached by the principal again to come up with another, you know, conspiracy theory elective. And I'm a huge JFK buff. And your book, Critical Thinking About the Kennedy Assassination, had just released. And I ordered the book, read the book, and decided that I was going to make the next elective in conspiracy theories a critical thinking course about the Kennedy assassination. So I'm in the process right now of writing that course, and hopefully it will launch in the fall.
Okay, that's good to know. So I guess I'm going to be on Jesse Ventura's radar now, because I'm brainwashing the American children. It's not just it's not just those Canadian grunts. It's also the people in the land of the free that are reading my book. That's great.
Yes, I'm trying to get them in high school. So I'm thinking that that is the best way to combat misinformation with this up and coming, you know, generation. So if we can pre-bunk, I think we'll be in a better position, you know, 10, 20 years down the road.
Before we get into one of our main themes, which is your involvement in a murder investigation, indirectly, you're identified as a bit of a filmmaker and a former actor online, wherever I've seen it. Now, we're going to be talking about this film, what's it called, Through Hike, later on. Have you acted in anything else apart from Through Hike?
My sixth grade Christmas play called Christmas Magic, that was my acting ability. It goes along with the story when I blame my wife, all right, for this whole entire story. She's the one that noticed the tiny little classified ad in the newspaper that said that there was a horror film being shot in the area. in Lebanon and Lancaster counties up on the Appalachian Trail, and actors and crew were needed. And at this time, I was working in the movie business. I was working on the exhibition side of the business, and was a corporate trainer for one of the largest theater exhibitors at that time in the nation. And I always wanted to get into film production. So my wife notices this classified ad. She says, hey, you should give this guy a call. I seriously just wanted to hold a boom mic on the set. I just wanted to see my name in credits. And so I called and I talked to the director of the film. His name was Blaine Norris. And he, through talking to me, asked my age and that type of thing. And, you know, described for him, like, you know, what I look like. And he said that I fit the age range of the cast that he was looking for. And he was only looking for six actors, five hikers and his killer. And he knew who the killer was going to be. He knew who one of the actresses was going to be. She was a soap star, you know, from New York. And so he said to me, I told him I would audition on the condition that when I don't get the part, he would hire me for the crew. And that was the deal that we struck. And I was given some lines to read, studied those lines, went to this audition, and he posted cast and crew positions on on the website, and I didn't see my name. And I kind of freaked out, and I called him on the phone and said, hey, I saw you posted the crew positions. What's the deal? And he told me then that the reason I didn't get a crew position was because he wanted me to play the role of Alan in his horror movie. And when I got the script, to my surprise, Alan is the second to last character that's killed in this, you know, slasher type.
Top billing.
And I'm in the second, I go until the second to last scene. So my girlfriend in the film is the one who kills me through possession.
Oh, now you ruined it for me. Don't tell me how it ends.
You're not going to see it because it's buried in the evidence locker in the East Pennsboro Police Department, and it was never finished. So the script is about as far as you're going to get with knowing what happens in that movie.
Okay. Well, we will be talking a bit more about the film in a bit. So it was a very short acting career then.
Yes.
You've made two films. One of them we'll talk about. It's called Rough Cut. And another one, very briefly, but I know that you have also a side interest in the Holocaust and Holocaust studies. And this film, I believe, is called Misha's Fugue. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's Misha's Fugue.
Sorry, Misha.
Misha, yes. It's a Czech for Michael. So when I got my job teaching at Fleetwood, reading about the Holocaust and studying about the Holocaust was something that my uncle and I had done. And we were actually in the process of planning a trip over to Europe, where he was going to, you know, take me around a tour, all of these locations. He ended up passing away like suddenly. So we never got to do that. But when I got to the high school, I had a degree in communications and film. So I basically could teach any subject as long as you could incorporate film into the curriculum. Well, I had a vast library of Holocaust films and Holocaust knowledge through film and that type of thing. There was a Holocaust elective in the school. And so I co-wrote a Holocaust elective with this teacher. And I was sent to Indianapolis for training through the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And I met Frank Misha Grunwald there. He was a Holocaust survivor who was speaking. And his story just absolutely blew me away. But the unique thing about his story was he had hundreds of photographs pre-war of his family. And then he tells us the story about this letter that his mother wrote to her husband just minutes before she was gassed in Auschwitz with Frank's older brother. And Frank told this group of teachers that he still had this letter in his possession. And I was sitting there listening to this man speak, and the documentary filmmaker inside of me just took over. And I still have the note book, and I just started writing down all these ideas. I asked him if he wanted to make a movie and could we document his story. So I used 11 teachers that span six different departments in the high school and 200 current and former students from the music department, the art department, the tech ed department, the English department. And we put together this documentary film called Misha's Fugue that's been seen in like 80 countries around the world, sold a pile of DVDs, and the film was nominated for two regional Emmy Awards. Wow. Yeah, it was... you can watch it on Amazon Prime if you're a Prime member free.
The same titles are not always available in Canada, so I'll have to check. But I remember when you and I were talking over email, we had talked about various things, and I think I looked for it and I couldn't find it here. So I might have to cheat or fix my VPN somehow.
Yeah, I'll get your copy.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Well, I do have a copy of Rough Cut. I watched it again today. I've watched it twice now. So we're going to be talking about that soon. Juwan, do you have any general questions that you want to ask or anything before we move on?
Yeah. Sean, how the filmmaking came to you? It's just for wanting to have to see your name on the screen?
That's all it was. All I wanted to do was experience sitting in a movie theater, seeing a credit roll, and seeing my name on the screen. And what ended up happening was I got sucked into this, you know, through hike a ghost story that ended up being this documentary film called Rough Cut. And I ended up, you know, not only being in the film, the documentary, because of what happened, but seeing my name up there credited as writer and producer. And I mean, I've always loved filmmaking. I've always loved film. I'm that type of film nerd that I'll watch a movie. If I really like it, I'll watch the director commentary where, you know, you sit there for 2.5 hours listening to the director talk about all the mundane things about their film. I mean, I have an extensive DVD collection. I just love movies.
Yeah. Well, we share some common aspects of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And Juwan also, I think you did you do documentaries? You did some short films, Juwan. I remember I held the boom for one of them. And then he and I were going to do a mockumentary, which I started writing the script, and we actually filmed some of our friends. This is like 15 years ago, playing different roles, and it never materialized. So
the production is quite expensive, let me tell you.
Yeah. Neither of us has been arrested. So the film, whatever bits still exist, if they do somewhere in Juwan's stuff, might be visible someday. But I don't think they're worth much right now to watch because it's only little snippets.
What was the premise of your mockumentary, if I can ask?
Well, I have invented a superhero called Captain Zeno, and it's kind of an alter ego I've been dragging around with me for over 20, maybe, I think since high school, actually. And I've actually written one short story. I have started two novels. I often make references. It's the kind of thing that it's my own little personal fantasy world, and I talk about it with other people, and their eyes kind of roll into their skulls there, and they're like, okay, I don't know what he's talking about. But it's given me a lot of happiness in my own little fantasy space, yeah.
So what makes it a mockumentary then?
Our idea was to create a number of sightings of this character who goes around saving people. He's not particularly agile. He doesn't have very useful superpowers. You know, I grew up watching Greatest American Hero. I like movies like Mystery Men. Have you heard of the movie Mystery Men?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
So, you know, it's a little bit in that vein, but also I teach philosophy. So I draw some ideas from Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and, you know, Rousseau. And so these people become kind of superheroes, failed superheroes. It's like The Boys, but it's more PG than R, you know. So we need to move on. Maybe we'll do an episode on Captain Zeno at some point. So let me head on. Let's just transition towards our first chapter. As is fitting with a season closer, the three of us will be revisiting and discussing some of the themes we looked at during this podcast season, namely the JFK assassination, which we've started already, and true crime, which we will now, as well as robots, because, well, robots are evil. We'll also start our own particular form of Fight Club, which will involve a death match between Sean and Juwan, so you don't want to miss that, unless you're a chicken. All right, so there's a musical transition here. There'll be some kind of a film clip about a chicken.
What's the matter, Colonel Sanders? chicken.
And then we move on to chapter one.
Get on with it.
Yes, get on with it.
Chapter one, shoot me now, stab you later.
With screams like that, this actress landed a starring role in a homemade horror movie. Tonight, the story of how it turned into a real-life horror. Good evening and welcome to Dateline. I'm Stone Phillips.
And I'm Ann Curry. The movie was the longtime dream of an amateur filmmaker. He was hoping his little ghost story would lead to a big Hollywood contract. But this wasn't part of the script.
Oh my God, I just got home. My wife's on the floor. She's bleeding really bad.
A young woman found murdered, police mystified by a crime scene that seemed staged.
This was almost like I'd walked into a movie set.
Investigators tried to figure out if there was a connection between the horror film and her death. Would someone commit murder just to make a movie?
One of the things he said to us was, tell everybody you know about Thru Hike. Tell everybody, tell your mom, your friends, and just spread the word. So we did, and now there's nothing to show for it, except for a crazy murderer.
This guy who has this Boy Scout background, you know, turning violent and killing someone, I just find it hard to believe. I can't believe that he would have done something like this.
So we are going to be talking about, or we did talk about true crime a few episodes ago. Sean, I don't know if you heard those episodes, but I spoke to a lawyer, a former death row lawyer called Andrew Hamill, who is now a translator and a writer of, I guess he's a writer of true crime, although he tries to debunk some innocence claims, particularly by Adnan Syed and Jens Søring. So Andrew Hamill has just recently appeared in a Netflix special about the Jens Søring case, who was a German young man who came to the United States on a scholarship, fell in love with a kind of a troubled young lady who was kind of Canadian, British, South African or some of that. And they both got together in some mad folie à deux, he calls it, and they murdered this young lady's parents. Her name was Elizabeth Hasem. So anyway, so we had an episode on, and then you and I had either started talking or we were just about to talk. And then you were asking me questions online about my course on Kennedy and about the podcast. And I Googled you. And when I Googled you, what came up was a transcript for a Dateline NBC program. It was called Double Exposure. And it was the story of the murder of a young woman called Randy Trimble. Did you actually meet Randy Trimble before the killing?
I did not have the pleasure of meeting Randy. I had heard stories, comments, that type of thing about Randy from Blaine and from Brian.
Okay, so let's pick up the story there, because you've already told us a little bit about how you got involved in this film.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about the film and about its director, whose name was Blaine Norris.
Yes. So Blaine put together this ragtag group of actors and crew, and he was a former Eagle Scout. And he wrote this script called Thru Hike, A Ghost Story. And the script tells the story of five college-age hikers who are going to hike the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine. And the story takes place, the whole premise behind why they're doing this is they were high school friends. They separate, all go off to college, and then they agree to get back together and do something together as a group after college, you know, kind of like to rebond. And so they decide that they're going to hike the entire Appalachian Trail. And Thru Hike, A Ghost Story tells the story of a couple days when they make it into Pennsylvania, and they end up discovering this abandoned coal mine. And they inadvertently release the ghost, the spirit of this old coal mining baron who's throughout the film becomes a little bit stronger At first, he can only, you know, make noises. Then he can move objects all the way up to the point where, you know, when the film closes, he has the capabilities to, like, possess people. So he systematically hunts each one of us down, you know, throughout this night. And the thing that I liked about the script was that he basically wins in the end, you know, to set up the sequel. So Blaine tells us, you know, about this story, and we started, you know, rehearsing in backyards, at local parks. You know, we were gonna hike into the woods and camp. So he was teaching us about camping, and I mean, we literally were living in a campground, and then we're going into the woods, you know, in the middle of the night to film.
From what I could get from the different things I read and watched, it seems to be like a cheap knockoff of Blair Witch Project, you know, mixed with one of those Bruce Lee movies where there's always a new battle and eventually everybody gets killed, or like Kill Bill or something like that. In retrospect, do you think it was a good movie script, or was it just something that at that time seemed good but wasn't?
I was young, dumb, naive, so I will be lying to you if I told you when I read it, if I didn't think that it was good. My judgment was a little clouded. Others in the cast will tell you they felt like some of the script was a little Scooby-Doo-ish.
That's what Aaron Lampard told NBC. Yeah.
But, you know, she had a great time, you know, like when we were up filming. She's really cool. She and I are Facebook friends. She's a stand-up comedian now. She's out in LA. But I have videos of her doing some stand-up routines while we're in the woods. I don't know if you've ever been on a movie set, but Hurry Up and Wait is about as true a cliche of filmmaking as there can be. And there was a lot of hurry up and waiting. So we had to entertain ourselves in the woods.
Okay, so you told us a little bit about what it was like to make the film. Tell us a bit about this guy, Blaine Norris. How did he strike you then? Because let's face it, the story centers about him and what he's going to do next. So what were your impressions of Blaine Norris at that time?
So when I first met Blaine, if there's one word that I could use to describe him, it was very driven. He was an Eagle Scout. He was married. He and his wife had just had a baby. He sold his house, you know, to get money to do this picture. He had an investor. He had, you know, Brian set up to be his cinematographer. He had all this stuff planned out. Everything was scheduled. When I say he was a planner, it was the snacks we were going to eat. You know, we're literally, snack time was noted. You know, it was a line in the schedule and what we were going to eat. So he had all this figured out, and we, the five of us, the six of us really, you know, just kind of surrendered to his call. And he, you know, directed the film. When we lost Brian, he, you know, was going to shoot the film. He was hell-bent on making his movie.
Was he just nerdy or was he creepy?
Very, very. No, he was nerdy. Sexual jokes like kind of flew around that set like crazy, but I never got the impression that Amber or Aaron, you know, were ever uncomfortable. I'm sure they would have said something, you know, if that were the case, but he would make some sexual jokes and stuff like that, but it was all, I think, just in jest and, you know, fun banter. He was definitely a nerd. I mean, he was a movie nerd, and a movie nerd in the sense that my character, the bio of my character was that I was the movie nerd in the movie. So as we're hiking, I'm constantly talking about horror films. I'm quoting horror films. And he was asking me, have you ever seen The Evil Dead? Have you ever seen Halloween? Have you ever seen the original Friday the 13th? The only one of those films at that time that I had not seen was The Evil Dead. So he would have get-togethers at his house where I would come over there. We'd sit down and he'd school me, you know, on The Evil Dead so I could, you know, get into this character. You know, I walked around my getup, my costume in the film. I was wearing an original John Carpenter Halloween t-shirt and cargo pants. So he definitely was a movie nerd, and horror films were definitely his genre of choice.
Okay. And so you do this film. I think you're in the post-production stage where you're starting to put the film together. And then there's this whole drama happening. I'm trying to summarize it for our listeners so that we can do this kind of succinctly. Blaine had a friend called Brian Trimble. Was Brian was kind of involved in the project, but he couldn't be on location because he had multiple sclerosis. Did you ever meet Brian? Was he involved hands-on, or was it just some guy out there with a title?
So we had our first, it was called a meet and greet, where the cast and the crew could all get together. And we were told to bring our families. So I actually brought my wife, and she got to meet Blaine, she got to meet Brian, she got to meet the rest of the people that were in the cast and some of the crew members. I met Brian at this meet and greet, and I remember Brian as being a little not standoffish, that's the wrong word, but he was a little concerned. He couldn't sit still, kind of thing. And when I asked Blaine if Brian was okay, having just met him, Blaine told me that he's just got to get out of here because his wife doesn't want him to participate in the film project. So Blaine did his little speech. Brian came in, said he was going to be, you know, the cinematographer on the film. And then he had to bail. So he bailed and he went home. And then the next time I met Brian was when, again, we were having another rehearsal. And this rehearsal was actually in Blaine's backyard at his parents' house. And Brian had set up like a backdrop to take these god-awful headshots that ended up on the official website for the movie. And again, he was there, he took the headshots, and he bailed.
The website's still there, right? I saw it today.
Is it still there? Yep. I didn't know if you had to go in the Wayback Machine to see it.
No,
but,
it's been archived. The page is archived. Some bits are missing, but I actually saw the one that was in the 10-year-old Dateline program.
My picture that's on that thing is so hideous. I don't even think I was ready for Brian to snap the picture. And I was like turning and looking and getting ready to say something to him, and he snaps the picture, and he's like, okay, got it, good, see ya.
Well,
and I didn't see what the picture was until it was posted on the website. And I remember saying to the other actors, I said to all of them, I was like, those pictures were hideous. And ultimately, it ended up being the reason why we lost the investor. The investor hated the headshots, too. And he said something to Blaine. And Blaine basically gave him his check back, told him, you know, when you signed on to do this, you know, he wanted a silent partner. And this guy wasn't going to be silent. You know, so, and he took his money and he left and he bailed. I mean, there were red flags, you know, throughout the whole production. And Blaine told us at one rehearsal, again, a different rehearsal, that Brian was not going to be able to make the trip into the woods, that his wife was concerned because he had multiple sclerosis. We were going to be shooting this movie in the woods. We were going to spend, I think it was something like a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks, in the woods shooting this movie, and she didn't want him to do this. She was a speech and language pathologist, so she had like a medical background, and worked in at the Hershey Hospital, I believe it was. So she knew what she was talking about, basically. And if he had multiple sclerosis, I don't think he does, but you know, that's a conversation for a different day. But he ultimately ended up not being able to go. So then Blaine said it's okay because Brian, you know, was gonna show him how to operate the camera and everything, and he was gonna shoot his own film. Again, another red flag, but I'm blinded by the idea that I'm gonna be in an independent horror film, you know, and I don't see these flags.
Yeah. So your director, Blaine, he's kind of obsessive, but he's lost his source of financing. He wants to get this movie done. It's kind of like his little project to become an actual director at some point.
Yeah.
His director of photography is not particularly talented. You know, nobody's particularly impressed with his work. And he has a relationship with his wife, which I guess depending on how we look at it, from the documentary, she seemed like a very responsible, money-conscious person. She looks a bit like a brunette version of Molly Ringwald, if you remember that actress. Mm-hmm. But she ends up dead all of a sudden. And it's a gruesome, bloody murder.
Yes.
And nobody thinks that Brian Trimble has the wherewithal to actually kill his own wife or kill anybody for that matter.
Yes.
Right. So how did you hear about this murder, and what was kind of the fog of war, the confusion about why someone would want to kill this young woman? Were there rumors of her being controlling or manipulative? Like, did anybody think that Brian would kill his own wife, or was this kind of off everybody's radar?
So the way that I found out about it, so you have to understand like the makeup of Pennsylvania and like where we filmed and where everybody lives were all kind of spread out, okay, all over the place. So at this point, Blaine is living in Harrisburg, okay, and I am about an hour east of Harrisburg, closer to central Pennsylvania, Brian and Randy lived on the west shore, so they're west of Harrisburg. So we don't share the same news organizations. We don't share the same newspapers. So we're in post-production on the film. We have done some pickup shooting. There was a long pause. Blaine was kind of burned out. You know, and the only information I'm getting about the film at this point is through Blaine, maybe half a dozen emails, you know, back and forth throughout the day. And Blaine invites me to his apartment to edit. And so I show up at his house in March. And so the murder occurred in January. Okay. I knew nothing about it. Didn't hear anything about it. No one was talking about it. It was all over the news, you know, but I wasn't paying attention to the news. So the murder happened in January. So it was February, March. So it's 3 months, okay, after this murder occurs. I show up at Blaine's apartment. It is just Blaine and I in the apartment. And I remember he came to the door and he said to me, "Hey, guess what scene we're going to edit today?" And I was like, "What's that?" And he's like, "Your death scene." And I was like, "Awesome." So we walk in. I went to his little, you know, editing bay that he had set up. And we're sitting here. I'm logging numbers and he's cutting, you know, I think he was using Final Cut at the time. And we're editing the death scene. I mean, we're putting the audio of like a knife going into a watermelon that we lugged up into the woods to get the nature sounds in the middle of the night. We're putting all that audio to my death scene, which is gruesome. I get stabbed multiple times with a miner's pick by my girlfriend, who is now possessed by this ghost. Okay, so my character takes like a brutal stabbing. So we're doing this, and in the middle of editing this, he turns and as he has his hand on the mouse and his face is buried in the screen, he's like, "Hey, you know all this work we're doing might be for naught." And I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about?" You know, and he said, "All this work that we're doing, it might be for nothing." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And he said, "You didn't hear." And I'm like, "Hear what?" And he said, "You didn't hear what happened to Brian's wife." And I'm like, "No, I didn't hear what happened to Brian's wife." And he said, he stops editing and he turns in and he looks at me and he said that back in January, he said Brian went out to dinner with a group of friends. And when he came home, he found his wife, Randy, murdered. And he found her dead in a pool of blood in the garage. And I immediately was like, "Is Brian okay?" And he's like, he goes, "I mean, he's obviously torn up about it, but he'll be okay," or something like that. And I said to him, "What does this have to do with the movie?" And he said these exact words to me. He said, well, he said the cops are investigating this murder, and they questioned me, and they find it fishy, suspicious, that I'm directing a horror movie. And I knew enough about the film industry at that point where I'm like, I said, Blaine, I said, that doesn't make any sense. And he goes, well, what do you mean? And I said, if the cops are looking at you just because you made a horror film, I said, why aren't, you know, John Carpenter and Sam Raimi and, you know, Toby Hooper, you know, and I started naming all these horror movie directors. I said, why aren't these people locked up? You know, like their movies are a whole hell of a lot more brutal than, you know, what this is. And he goes, yeah, I know, it doesn't make any sense. And then we just got right back to editing. And I was concerned now that for these bogus reasons, the cops were going to take this film before we had a chance to finish it, because it never in a million years crossed my mind that Brian was involved in this murder, and it really never crossed my mind that Blaine was involved in this murder. And Blaine was the type of guy, when we were walking through the woods, he's like, hey, don't touch that. And he's like telling me the genus species of, you know, this type of plant, and it's poisonous, and this tree is this. And he's telling us, like, so this guy was like into nature. He was protecting innocent animals, you know, in the woods while we were there. So it never in a million years crossed my mind that he had anything to do with this.
But you didn't know at that time that he was like the next suspect the police had, the next best suspect.
No.
Because Brian apparently had an alibi.
Yep.
Although one of his coworkers suspected that Brian had killed his wife because he'd been talking about a divorce and money problems and things like that. So Brian gets seen as the prime suspect, but the police find that, well, he couldn't have been there, and he's not the type to do this. Now, you said something that kind of struck me there, because it didn't come out in the news and your documentary, that it was during a stabbing scene of the film, mm-hmm. very similar, at least in a certain way, in the way that Randy got killed.
Mm-hmm.
So now I realize why Blaine, at that moment, turned to you. Because the scene seems to remind him of the scene of the murder, right?
Yeah.
Now, in retrospect, we can see that he has a memory of the murder, which allows mm-hmm. him to then have that reaction with you.
So what ended up happening here is I fell down this rabbit hole afterwards of, it was almost, I mean, it was probably like a type of depression. I had guilt. I was questioning my judgment. I started really looking into reading books about sociopaths with a bloodlust, looking into the psychology of serial killers. I was in a really, really dark place. And the more I did that, the more I started to make these connections in hindsight. And in Rough Cut, I talk about how the characters in the film are Doug, Eric, Alan, Terry, and Heather, which their first letters spell the word death. And then if you throw Samuel Toon onto the end of it, it's, you know, obviously deaths in the plural. Well, as we were hiking through the woods, I made the connection like, hey, I'm this movie nerd. Blaine's a movie nerd, you know, And there's these bios of all of these characters, and, you know, even the females that are in the film are the type of girls that Blaine would go after. Like, one is a little bit nerdy, the other one is attractive, you know, more reserved. But then there's, you know, Doug, who's the jokester, and then there's Eric of our group, who's the leader. He's our Eagle Scout, you know, who's in the woods. So I make this connection between all of these characters and different parts of Blaine's personality. And I told Blaine, I said, the only character that I couldn't make a connection to was Samuel Toon. And he looked at, I remember where we were on the trail as we were walking to the next scene. And he turned and he looked at me with this smile on his face. And he said, how about that? You know, when I told him I couldn't connect the killer to him, and he said, how about that? And we walked away. Now, if you look in the script, Doug is thrown off of an abandoned railroad bridge and splats on the rocks below. Eric, he is strangled. Aaron, my character, is stabbed multiple times. Terry, she is drowned. And then there's Heather, who is bludgeoned to death.
But are you suggesting here that Blaine was fantasizing through this film of murders he wanted to commit in real life?
Yes. When Randy came home and she walked into the dining room of her house, Blaine and Brian had tossed the home to make it look like this was a burglary gone bad, like she had interrupted a burglary. He was pissed because he was waiting in the house for her for hours. She was late. There's this whole Kevin Spacey 7 thing that kind of happens with Blaine in real life in Rough Cut that we don't draw like those connections to, but I know you'll be interested in hearing this. But he jumped on her back. He took a cord from a Christmas decoration and he threw it up around her neck. Well, she was quick enough to get her hand in between the cord and her neck so she could create a little space. So he couldn't get what he called complete strangulation, and she was fighting him. So he drug her. So now that's strangulation. Okay, that's the first thing he tried that didn't work. Then he takes her into the garage where he, you know, tries to knock her out by hitting her head, you know, off the garage floor. My character, my girlfriend in Through Hike, she dies by getting bludgeoned, you know, into a tree by the ghost, okay? So now he does this and she is still pleading for him to stop. And then he had a gun strapped to his one leg, and he had a 6-inch Gerber Gator knife strapped to his other leg, and he told the police that he didn't want to leave any ballistics behind or whatever. They actually found books on forensics and how forensics are collected, and he knew all about ballistics, and they, Blaine had taken notes in the margins of these books. Like, he and Brian thought that they were going to be smarter than the police.
Do you think then that the movie was a rehearsal for him to kill eventually, or it's just that when he became desperate, needing money, and this friend of his was going through a rough time. He thought his wife was controlling, wanted a divorce, but couldn't bring about himself. So it was kind of a desperate act, but he had the script of the movie in his mind to kind of inspire him on how to kill.
I can't say with 100% certainty that he was acting out this fantasy of murdering somebody through this film. I can't, but if you look at the 5 ways that we died in the film, I mean, the only 2 of those 5 things that he did not try or attempt when he actually committed murder was obviously throwing someone off a bridge or drowning somebody, and they weren't, you know, in an elevated place or around a body of water. So I don't know.
So, Blaine Norris and Brian Trimble get both arrested on conspiracy to murder. Blaine did the killing. Randy did the helping out or the planning or
whatever. Brian.
Yes.
Yeah, Brian did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're both in prison probably for the rest of their lives.
Yep.
One of the police officers was interviewed on NBC, and I think in your documentary, the name I got was Dougherty, so I don't know if that's the one you were thinking about. He actually says that Blaine, in his view, was a serial killer in the making. Not a desperate guy trying to get some money in the only way he found possible to nourish his obsession with becoming a filmmaker. Do you agree with that? That this guy had he not killed Randy, he would have killed other people?
Yes. And I will tell you that for 2 reasons. 3 reasons. One, because I studied serial killers and he definitely fit the MO, but for 2 other reasons. One, those notes that he had sent to the police, a la the Zodiac Killer, trying to throw the cops off of his trail, he signed those notes, Trooper. And when he was arrested, and the cops, raided his apartment and did a search in his apartment, they found an application in his desk to be a Pennsylvania state trooper. So my guess was that he maybe had plans to get into the police academy, become a state trooper, and this guy was going to kill people when he wasn't out being a cop. And if you sit there and you think about, you know, the Golden State Killer, he was a former police officer. You know, it's not the first time. It's not out of the realm of possibility for something like that. But the real reason why I believe it is because of this story that not very many people know that I will share with you guys here on this podcast. There was an audio tech on our film. His name was Ryan. He happened to be the super of the apartment building that Blaine moved into when he left his wife. So Ryan says, hey, I got this vacant apartment in this building that I own, and you're more than welcome to it. That's where we went to edit. Now, Ryan, living in this apartment with Blaine, actually saw Blaine the night of the murder coming down the fire escape after he had driven across the river, committed this crime, and came back. What I did not know was that Ryan was being questioned by the police and putting a timeline together, and Ryan was basically questioning whether or not Blaine was telling him the truth. Because Blaine was like, hey, if the cops ask, tell them you saw me around this time. So Ryan's talking to the cops about Blaine and about this investigation. I have no idea that any of this is occurring. I'm emailing Blaine almost on a daily basis, asking him when we are going to edit more of this movie. Blaine sends me this email asking me that we needed to do some pickup shots. We needed to go into the woods in the middle of the night, and we needed to just, you know, take shots of the empty trails, the moon through the trees, get audio of, you know, all the bugs and the crickets and the sounds, you know, in the forest and in the woods in the middle of the night. Ryan, he said, you, me, and Ryan will go. It's only going to be the three of us. And I'm like, sounds awesome. Sign me up. When are we going? You know, and I am pushing and pushing and pushing on these email lists to go to the woods. Ryan is talking to the cops. Ryan is intimately involved now in this investigation that I pretty much know nothing about. Ryan schedules a meeting with these two cops. They meet Brian in a diner in Hershey, and Ryan tells him that there is this actor in the film, and Blaine and I, he said, who are planning on going into the woods to get some pickup shots and some night sounds. And I'll never forget it. I think it was Chip Dougherty. Ryan told me this story after all of this stuff was done, but Ryan said that Chip looked at him, and Chip said, if the three of you want to have dinner in the middle of a crowded restaurant, he said, go right ahead. He said, but if the three of you want to go into the woods, he said, we are probably going to be hunting for two of you.
Oh, really?
When this is all said and done. And I had no idea that Ryan was, you know, running this interference for us, because this guy was living in his apartment and he's trying to figure out, is this guy, you know, capable of doing this? So Brian, he gives the police an 80 something page confession one night. And he cracked, and like sang like a canary in a coal mine. At the time the DC sniper case was going on in Washington, DC, Blaine had acquired a bunch of firearms and would target practice. And he was checking Brian like for wires, you know, when Brian came over to his apartment. He was basically paranoid. And I honestly think that if Blaine shoots Brian, he gets away with this murder. You know, because the cops would have no reason to go and search Blaine's apartment, you know, because there's no DNA. There's no forensic evidence whatsoever that connects Blaine to this crime scene. The cops, literally, they had nothing. The only thing they have now is Brian's confession. Well, like I said, Brian gave them an 80-something page confession, and the cops, you know, the next day or whatever it is, a couple days later, storm Blaine's apartment. And that's the breaking news story that I catch on the news. And I see his car being put up on a flatbed truck. It's a car I'd been in a dozen times, you know, playing with the CDs. You know, my fingerprints are all over the inside of that car. He's got a wall in his apartment full of medieval weapons that I was touching and playing with. I mean, they take his computer out of there. I mean, there's like 200 or some odd emails on that computer from me where there's a couple on there where I'm actually young, dumb, and naive talking trash like on the police. Like if they don't stop harassing you, you know, about this, you need to get an attorney. You know, that type of thing, because I wanted to finish this film. I see this computer, you know, being carried down the steps, and I mean, I freaked out because they're going to find my name in his computer, all these emails, they're going to read that stuff, you know, they're going to find my fingerprints inside his car. You know, I don't want to be connected to this, like, at all, and now I was sucked into it, and, you know, my wife told me to call a friend of ours who at that time was a defense attorney, and he told me, it was kind of funny, I'm only going to ask you this question once, he said, and based on your answer, he said, I'm totally going to give you different options. And he asked me if I had anything to do with this or had any prior knowledge, you know, that this was going to happen. And I told him, you know, absolutely 1,000% no. And he told me, he said, when you hang up the phone with me, he said, call the district attorney where the murder occurred. And he said, let them know that you have information about the Randy Trimble murder. And he said, they're going to put you on the phone with the detectives. Well, I called the detectives and, you know, Mike told me, he said that you want to go to them. He said, you don't want these people, you know, showing up to your work. And making a scene. So,
but you were never treated as a suspect, were you?
No, because they were gearing, the cops were gearing up to go to trial when Blaine ultimately caved and ended up confessing. So I think that had they gone to trial, that the actors in the film would have had some part, you know, in the trial, whether we would be character witnesses for Blaine, you know, like I could tell them the rabbit story, you know, and that type of thing. I mean, but I think that we were the only two from the film, you know, that had reached out to the police. And I just told them that we would, you know, I would obviously cooperate with anything they needed. And the officer that I talked to was Les Freeling. And he told me, thank you for calling. He wanted me to print all the emails out. And I printed them all out and sent them a package. But like I said, Blaine ended up confessing. And they ultimately, you know, never went to trial. So we were never called. We were never questioned. But then here I come, you know, a couple months later with a documentary film crew and a director, you know, and we're actually interviewing the cops about the whole entire case.
Yeah. I'll put a link to the transcript of the Dateline program. If you know of any place that people can actually watch it online, let me know and I'll put that on our website. You went on to do this documentary film, Rough Cut. We don't really have time to go into details here because there's a whole story about how you've had some difficulty making it available to the public because the director kind of had other issues. But ultimately, I think you looked deep into kind of the darkest part of the human nature, I guess, in doing this this documentary film. Did you ever interview Blaine's family, his ex-wife, his parents? Did you ever get any insight from them whether he had a long history of kind of deviant behavior or intentions?
No. I mean, obviously, covering all your bases, you know, you want to interview everybody that you possibly can. But no, his parents, you know, obviously were not going to cooperate with a documentary film. I think it was his sister and brother-in-law, they did come into my work when we were in the initial stages of doing the documentary film. But, you know, obviously because they were, you know, family members, they were not going to participate in the documentary. I actually sent two letters to Blaine when he was in prison, because I wanted to be completely upfront with him and tell him what I was doing, because I didn't want him sitting in prison and ultimately see a newspaper article or whatever it was, you know, about this film. So he never wrote back. The only person who he wrote back to was when the producers from Dateline NBC wrote him that they were going to be doing a story on, you know, this killing. He wrote them back telling them that he's not interested in doing that story, but he would definitely be interested in doing a story about, you know, overcrowded prisons in the state of Pennsylvania and that type of thing. And obviously Dateline's not interested, you know, in doing
that. Not in
that.
His opinion anyways. Yeah.
In his opinion. Yeah. That was,
he
that
blew
was...
it. He blew it once already. He's not going to get that chance back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, as far as anybody in their family participating in Rough Cut, we talked to some people, like I said, behind the scenes, friends of his, you know, that type of thing, but no one from his family. And he, you know, obviously, you know, wasn't going to participate. But we had some stuff, you know, we knew a lot about where his mind was. He wrote letters to everybody before he went to prison and before he was actually caught. The cops did a forensic analysis of his computer, and on his computer, they actually found an entire script that he had conjured up in his mind, that if he were on the witness stand, you know, the questions that prosecutors were going to ask him and how he was going to answer these questions and everything. And we had these letters, so we kind of knew. He wrote letters to the cast and crew of the film. He wrote letters to Brian. He wrote letters to a bunch of different people. And that was one of the things that Kurt, one of the detectives, was able to put together. In all the letters, he was talking about, don't believe, you know, how the cops painted me out to be. You guys know who I am. And he said this in every one of the letters besides the letter that he wrote to Brian. In the letter to Brian, it was, hey, can you, you know, send some money to my son? And Kurt knew right away that they had their guy.
So he did confess, but he never seemed to show remorse or to apologize for what he did in a kind of convincing way, right?
No, well, he entered, I forget what the heck they call it in the courtroom, but he had an opportunity to address the court, you know, when he pled guilty. And in the transcript of that, he has this long speech about God and the Bible. And that he is, you know, terribly sorry. If he could obviously trade his life for Randy's, he would do that. He said that to, you know, Randy's mother. And then, you know, he talked about God. And then he said that from what he has read about, you know, Christianity and God, that God forgives him for what he did. I mean, at that point, everything was so raw. I mean, everybody kind of laughed it off as like a joke. He was obviously very serious about this. I never got the sense that Blaine was like as religious as he was, because, you know, he was going to like swingers clubs and all kinds of things, like living the bachelor life. But there was a woman online who found out that Blaine started his own, like a church kind of thing, in prison, where he teaches people about, you know, the Bible and Christianity and that type of stuff, and started this, almost like a treatment kind of facility, for, you know, former prisoners and stuff like that. He's never going to see the light of day. I mean, he got life in prison without the possibility of parole. Brian got the exact same thing. So, you know, it's, yeah.
It doesn't end in a way that brings kind of peace to anybody, right?
No.
I mean, no. One of the reasons that your story resonated so much with me, I don't know if you listened to our episode on true crime, but I did write an essay there about a guy I played hockey with. Now, we're not super close, but I mean, for 10, 12 years, we played together. And yeah, sometimes things got heated, but I consider him my friend. You know, he had this beautiful wife who suddenly was killed in the middle of the night. He took off the body with him. Apparently he cut parts of the body, and he tried to commit suicide. That's what we know from the news. The case is pending. I've tried to see if I could send him like a Christmas card, because I'm not trying to forgive anything. I believe that certainly he shares some responsibility in that. I don't know if it's first degree, second degree, or whatever. But when someone close to you commits an act, allegedly, you know, that is so heinous, something is shaken, right? And your entire view of human nature, your own potential, you know, to fly off the rails and hurt somebody, mm-hmm. someone close to you, right? You either paint people as Hitlers, as monsters, or you realize that there's a little bit of that in all of us, right? So I guess maybe we can end with this. Maybe Juan has a question, but after this whole experience, has your, I don't know, your faith in human nature, your faith in the good, your hope in the future, has this been tarnished? Are you a hopeful person, or are you cynical because of this close brush you got with a murderer?
That's a great question. So shortly after, I had always considered myself a great judge of character. Well, that ended when I met Blaine Norris. Now, again, I'd only known him for, I mean, maybe 2 years, you know, working on this film, a little over a year. So it wasn't like we were close by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, I worked with him, you know, from the very beginning of his film, you know, through to the end of it, you know, and then through the making of Rough Cut, like I was intimately involved in this story. And shortly afterwards, I had nightmares about him in the very beginning. And some of these were like really scary. And you go to this dark place. But I'm a researcher, you know, by nature. And so I wanted to study, you know, the psychology of these people. And it did. It shook the foundation of my trust in my fellow human beings. And I will tell you this right now. I don't think that there's anything that anyone could do that wouldn't surprise me. You know, if that makes any sense, like people do dumb stuff for really dumb reasons, you know, and this guy, he made a really, really stupid decision that ruined, you know, some people's lives, from his family members to, you know, Randy's family. I mean, her uncle described it as like somebody dropped a bomb in the middle of their family, and he said, we're going to spend the rest of our lives picking up the pieces. And I'm like, that like visual image, like, I mean, it just, it hurts, you know, to think about that. But yeah, humans don't really surprise me anymore. When I hear like, you know, crazy stories in the news, I always think back. It was like, I was elbow to elbow with a guy who committed a heinous act and a murder almost 3-4 months to the day after he committed the murder, you know, and looked at me right in the face and tells me that he's not going to be able to finish his film because, you know, he's being harassed by the cops, you know, and I mean, he's just blatantly lying right to my face. I mean, I'm sure you experienced, you know, the same thing, probably even worse, because, you know, you knew your friend for a decade. Well, I'd only known Blaine for, like I said, a year.
But then you ask yourself, did I really know that person, right?
You don't. And let's be honest, like how this is the psychology of it. You know, how well do you really know people? Like, how well do you really know people? Like, I've been teaching for 16 or 17 years now in high school, you know, and if I'm being brutally honest, yeah, I really care for, you know, my fellow coworkers, but I'm not going home with them at night having long, drawn-out philosophical conversations about all kinds of things. I mean, we're all high school teachers, and, you know, we talk about teaching, you know, when we're at school. I've taught with these people for 16 and 17
maybe
years.
Maybe they're all at home killing kittens like Luca Rocco Magnata.
yeah, but at the end of the day, it's like, let's be honest, how well do you really know people? Like the answer is not well. You know, you don't know people that well. Like if we're just being honest.
Juan, do you want to add anything before we move on?
Yeah, a little question for both of you. Since you lived this traumatic event to being close to somebody that was a murderer, you know, like, did you seek professional help?
No, I didn't.
So you just start the kind of research and try to make sense of the thing by itself.
Yeah. I literally channeled all of that energy into making Rough Cut.
Okay.
Into writing and producing Rough Cut.
That was your way.
Yeah, I needed something immediately to take my mind off of it. And looking back on it now, like 15, 20 years later, Rough Cut was a cathartic experience, you know, in the sense that I got to talk to, you know, Randy's mother. I got to know her family, you know, her grandmother. I got to know who she was as a person. And that was one of the biggest things, you know, in making Rough Cut. You know, we were able to tell Randy's story and give Randy a voice, which was the main reason why we made that film. Of course, there's the sensational aspect, you know, of what happened to her, you know, and how she was no longer with us. But the process of making Rough Cut and getting to talk to the cops and seeing the behind the scenes stuff of how they solved that crime and, you know, what was going on behind the scenes and trying to like get inside Blaine's head and figure out, you know, some of the stuff that he was thinking. Rough Cut was a very cathartic experience. And I think that by the time Rough Cut released, you know, I had kind of processed all of that and I don't have those same feelings anymore until Dateline NBC calls or ID Discovery calls or, you know, Paranoid Planet calls.
Usually we just text.
And text, yeah, and says, hey, do you want to come on a podcast? But no, it shakes you. It really does.
I don't think that I was close enough to the event that I felt that I needed therapy. But I did talk to friends. And the problem is, in the circle of friends, people didn't want to talk much. Initially, we all got together at a casual spa, kind of like, it's like a sports bar. And, there was like 40 of us there, kind of all wondering what's going on. Two or three of us got together and we said, look, this is horrible. But at the same time, maybe it's because all three of us were practicing Christians. But we all felt like, here's a person who's done something horrible, but he is also alone. And we do believe in redemption, not like let them off scot-free. There's got to be, you know, the legal system has to do its job, but there also has to be at some point some kind of a restorative justice. But because there has been a court case yet, there's very little we can do. I actually called, I talked to a former prison chaplain that I knew who kind of gave me some ideas on how I could contact a prisoner. I actually contacted their prison, but because he was between lawyers, there was no one that I could actually contact. I'm not going to contact his dead wife's family, right? The one thing that really helped was one day, one of the guys who came to play with us was very close to him. I don't want to say who exactly, but someone who knows a lot more about the story. And then I was satisfied. The kids are taken care of. A lot of the financial issues with the kids are taken care of. And, you know, the legal system is doing its thing. But I think the issue for me is that this was only the second of two legal problems that have been going on the last few months. One has been going on since almost 2 years now, is that one of my former high school teachers has been arrested and convicted of sexual crimes with two boys who, this happened in the 80s and 90s, but these two guys were friends of mine at some point. So I do not doubt that they were actual victims. And what bothered me and all that is how close I came to being a possible victim. Because when I was in high school, I had conversations with this particular teacher, which looking back now, I feel I was maybe getting groomed. Was it deliberate or not? I may have been one of those people who could have eventually been a victim of this person. I don't want to go into too much detail about that, but that definitely is something where I had to take some time, talk to a pastor, talk to my wife, also former school friends who I'm still friends with, who also were in a similar situation as me. So I would say that therapy might help if you've actually been through trauma. In my case, neither of those two events were traumatic, but it certainly brought up a lot of anger and a lot of just questioning. And so at least having a community of people who understand, you know, talking to Sean about his experience helps me put a little bit of context. I don't think that Kevin is a guy like Blaine, but they both did something very similar. And so you can't escape the similarities.
Yeah. So as far as the seeking therapy, both of my children are interested in becoming therapists, psychologists. And I'm a big proponent of mental therapy. And it mainly stems from the really bad car accident that I had in 2018. I have PTSD from it. You know, I didn't get to experience the, you know, teaching your kids how to drive stuff because the air brake on my side of the car, the passenger side of the car, while my kids are driving, it never works. And I'm constantly paranoid, you know, when I get in the car, even now when I'm not driving. And therapy helped me deal with that PTSD. I think as good as it's going to, I still have episodes when I'm driving where panic a little bit, you know, if I'm sitting still in traffic, which was when the accident occurred. But I did therapy in the very beginning, I think 3 times a week to start. Then we went down to 2x a week, and then it was 1x a week, and I haven't had to check in, you know, with her in a while. But I was thinking every day that I was going to die. I would put pants on, you know, I'm like, yep, these are good pants to die in. And I couldn't stop these thoughts because of this accident. Like, loud noises now, absolutely can't stand them. Unfortunately, our school band, oh my Lord, that kills me. Like, I'll get a migraine headache that lasts for 3 days. I can't be anywhere around the band. Like, so pep rallies, you know, football games, like that type of stuff, I avoid all that stuff. Bright lights, loud noises, high beams, you know, that type of stuff, because it was 6:30 in the morning here and it was dark, and the last thing that I remembered was the whole cab of my car lighting up as her, you know, headlights got buried in my trunk, and, you know, then my car was airborne and I couldn't control anything. You talk about being religious and getting right with God. I remember when that car was flying through the air, I had conscious thoughts. I said, there is absolutely nothing that I can do to control this situation. That was the most helpless in my entire life I ever felt. And I'll probably cry just talking about it. But I remember sitting there thinking to myself, like, I'm going to die and I have to be okay with it. Like, I hate thinking about that, but it's like, yeah, it was... I felt helpless, you know, and I spent many, many hours in therapy. I missed 3 months of work, you know, dealing with the physical, you know, stuff that was wrong with me and, you know, regaining my balance and getting my brain right again, you know, not falling over, you know, when I closed my eyes. Like, it was terrible.
On that note, let's move on. I mean, it's kind of hard to lighten the mood.
Yeah, let's have our death match.
Seconds to go in the overtime, 22-19 San Francisco. McKinnon is in at running back, first down and goal to go. Play action fake, right side throw, touchdown! McCole Hardman with the catch! Kansas City wins the game! Champions of Super Bowl 58 on the heels of Super Bowl 57.
At Bold 3 Detergent Plus Fabric Soap.
Call toll free.
We now continue with Smurf.
All funky color.
It's impossible.
Level being seen, and it is virtual.
After the honeymoon, but when I got back and I found out that he'd stolen Ben,
lies have gotten all of us into so much trouble.
Hey ladies, has your chubby hubby grown despondent and depressed now that the NFL season is over? Has he been mistreating his insides with endless portions of turkey jerky, chicken wings, bacon and cheese chili dogs, light beer and mozzarella sticks, doing little else than watching sports from his lazy boy? Well, fret no more. My name is Rodney Spakowski. You may remember me from several audacious business ventures, instructional videos, and alternative educational programs, all of which enjoyed mild and mostly legal returns. But I'm here today to appeal to you hopeless housewives wondering what to do with that sleepy lump of flesh parked on your living room sofa, and to let you know that your future is looking brighter. That's right, you can now make your chubby hubby look great again with Dr. Chow Chow's Golden Fiesta Healthy Lifestyle Vitamin Chews, the perfect midwinter snack for the man in your life who spent a little too long watching professional athletes while neglecting his own musculature. Dr. Chow Chow's Vitamin Chews are specially patented by me, your friendly neighborhood online apothecary, with some help from a team of East Asian business professionals. They contain, I mean, the chews, not the East Asian business professionals, a powerful appetite suppressant for weight control, a blend of vitamins A, B, C, D, and E to give that extra perk of energy he's been missing from not eating fruits and vegetables, glucosamine, calcium, and potassium to heighten his reaction time, strengthen his brittle bones, and soothe his nervous reactions around strangers and loud noises, as well as a shot of omega-3, 6, and 14 fatty acids from fish oil to make his hair, or what's left of it, full and shiny again. Oh, and they also contain ivermectin to ward off COVID-19 and most intestinal parasites. That's Dr. Chow Chow's Golden Fiesta Healthy Lifestyle Vitamin Chews. Don't let the name fool you, they're perfectly suited for human consumption. In fact, I'm legally obliged to inform you that the FDA disapproves of the use of this product on pets, which of course doesn't impede humans from taking them in at this time. Though you'd think they could have warned us before we spent a fortune copywriting this name and settling out of court with those shysters at Purina. Dr. Chow Chow's Golden Fiesta Healthy Lifestyle Vitamin Chews. Get them while you still can.
Warning, this product has been rumored to make amphibians gay.
Oh, these are good. Wow, I really enjoy these. Tastes a little bit like, liver.
And that is the end of the first part of this final episode of Season 2. Join us real soon as Sean, Joanne, and I talk about JFK, analyze my fears of artificial intelligence, take part in a movie fan deathmatch, and take in a groovy new take on our podcast theme song. Until then, why not visit our website at www.paranoidplanet.ca, where you can get started recording your own version of our theme song. Find essays and related documents, like a link to Sean's true crime documentary, Rough Cut, and make a small contribution to help us keep this program rolling. Or you can just sit in the dark and stare at the back of your eyelids. It's entirely up to you. We'll see you soon.
Podcast about conspiracies, paradigm shift, and critical thinking.